Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, two Portland police officers face legal consequences for excessive use of force. The Department of Education says transgender students are protected under Title IX. And in international news, President Biden and Vladimir Putin meet in person for the very first time. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Wednesday, June 16th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Two Portland police officers are facing legal consequences from excessive use of force on the job. The first is Officer Corey Budworth. Budworth was indicted by a grand jury on a fourth-degree or misdemeanor assault charge connected to a protest on August 18th, 2020. During the racial justice protest, Budworth allegedly beat photojournalist Terry Jacobs repeatedly with a baton as she was leaving a protest. Jacobs filed a lawsuit in federal court in September over the assault. She was at the protest in a professional capacity and was wearing the appropriate credentials, according to the lawsuit. Jacobs was moving away from the protest as the police had ordered, but Budworth allegedly hit her with his baton repeatedly, and as she moved away, he chased her and continued assaulting her head and face. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt announced the indictment on Tuesday. Here's an excerpt of his announcement.
Earlier this afternoon, my office filed a criminal assault charge against Portland Police Officer Corey Budworth, stemming from what we allege to be an excessive and unlawful use of force on August 18, 2020, during a political protest. I want to start by thanking and acknowledging the Portland Police Bureau for their dedicated work on this investigation into one of their own. I further want to thank the many members of the Portland Police Bureau who have showed up night after night in response to civil demonstrations that have at times turned violent. Despite these pressures, these law enforcement professionals remain professional and their actions lawful. But when that line is crossed and a police officer's use of force is excessive and lacks a justification under the law, the integrity of our criminal justice system requires that we, as prosecutors, act as a mechanism for accountability. Public trust requires nothing less. And in this case, we allege that no legal justification existed for Officer Budworth's deployment of force and that the deployment of force was legally excessive under the circumstances.
The Union for Portland Police Officers, the Portland Police Association, has defended Officer Budworth and described his indictment as, quote, a politically motivated charging decision. Juan Chavez is the attorney for Jacobs, the victim. Chavez said in a statement, quote, "One indictment, while undoubtedly significant and a wake-up call to Portland police officers, will not fix problems with policing in our city. The criminal legal system may hold Budworth responsible for his actions and punish him for it, but it will not bring about the wholesale changes we need to culture, policy, and practice," end quote. Another Portland police officer is facing legal scrutiny as well. The Oregon Department of Justice is reviewing Portland Police Detective Eric Kammerer's use of force. The investigation was moved up to the state level because the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office said there might be a conflict of interest if they were to investigate Kammerer. The use of force that Kammerer is being investigated for isn't publicly known, but the officer was recently named in a lawsuit by a Portland resident who was reportedly beaten by police after being mistaken for a rioter last year. The U.S. Department of Education says that Title IX protects transgender students, too. Title IX is a part of a 1972 law that prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex in federally funded schools. That's public schools and higher education. The Education Department is now extending that ban on sex discrimination to include discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. The new guidance doesn't change the process for how complaints are made or how they're investigated. It's also unclear how it may impact legislative efforts in Republican-led states to restrict the rights of transgender students, including in sports. But the announcement comes a year after the Supreme Court ruled that workplace discrimination protections in the Civil Rights Act also applied to LGBTQ individuals. This most recent interpretation of Title IX is a reversal of Trump-era guidance on the issue. In the closing days of the former administration, Trump issued guidance that said Title IX only applied to biological sex. Advocates for transgender rights say the new guidance is especially important in places where state-level protections for transgender students don't exist. The announcement serves as a reminder to public schools and colleges that receive federal funding about what their obligations are when it comes to discrimination against trans students. President Biden had his first summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin today. There were a lot of hot-button issues to discuss, but coming out of the meeting, both agreed that the talk had gone pretty well. There was still division between the two leaders on important issues like cyber attacks and human rights. Putin denied any Russian involvement with cyber attacks in the United States. Biden indicated that the United States would pursue the issue of human rights abuses in Russia as well. After the talk, Biden was optimistic, saying Putin would not want to escalate tensions between the two nations. With that story and more, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
He's bright, he's tough, and I have found that he is a, as they say, when he used to play ball, a worthy adversary.
President Joe Biden is expected to take a tough line when he meets with Russian President Vladimir Putin in Switzerland. The Biden administration issued sanctions against Russia over its meddling in the 2020 U.S. election and the SolarWinds cyber attack. Putin also faces allegations of massing troops along the Ukrainian border. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he's putting Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee to work today.
Now that President Biden's fiscal 22 budget request has been received by Congress, the Budget Committee can begin the important work of producing a budget resolution.
A budget resolution will set the stage for passing an infrastructure package through reconciliation. But Schumer still plans to also bring a bipartisan infrastructure package to the floor. Several mayors presented their case for infrastructure investments before a Senate committee.
Housing is critical infrastructure.
Akron, Ohio Mayor Daniel Horrigan called for federal programs to encourage private real estate development. So did Tempe, Arizona Mayor Corey Woods.
Unfortunately, even with our city's own investments, private partnerships, and creative use of federal programs, we did not come close to meeting the needs of our cost-burdened residents, nor addressing our extraordinary increase in unsheltered individuals.
A national survey found infrastructure is the top priority for mayors in 2021. Texas Democrats, who blocked a Republican-backed election reform bill by walking off the state house floor, were in D.C. Tuesday, pushing for federal legislation that enhances voting access.
We are seeing an attack on voting rights when it comes to communities of color, Latinos, African Americans, and Asians, women, the disabled, and the elderly.
Texas Senate Democratic Caucus Chair Carol Alvarado is from Harris County, where she says vote by mail was widely successful in 2020. H.R. 1, an election reform bill, could get a Senate vote next week. June 19th is on its way to becoming a national holiday. The Senate passed a Juneteenth bill by unanimous consent commemorating the end of slavery in the Confederacy. House lawmakers approved a bill to give congressional gold medals to police officers who defended the Capitol on January 6th. 21 Republicans voted against the measure, with some calling it a ploy by Democrats to push a politically motivated narrative. Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and several House Republicans called for the ouster of Dr. Anthony Fauci. The group accused the nation's top infectious disease expert of misleading the public about COVID-19.
Let's not divide people with politics over a virus that has killed people. Let's bring America together in healing this nation by finally holding someone accountable.
Fauci has defended his response to the pandemic, noting that the science was evolving. With the nation emerging from the pandemic, the White House is readying for a July 4th Summer Freedom Party. Biden will host first responders, essential workers, and military service members and their families for a cookout and fireworks. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
A court ruling on Monday dealt a blow to tribal activists and their allies who are trying to halt the construction of the Line 3 pipeline in northern Minnesota. Project officials maintain that the new line will include strong environmental protections, but opponents say they'll keep fighting the plans. Mike Moen has more.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals has upheld approvals of permits for the Line 3 oil pipeline. The move is seen as a win for Enbridge Energy, the company behind the project, but tribal activists opposed to the effort say they'll keep fighting. In a 2-1 decision, the court said state regulators acted properly when giving their consent to Line 3, which is being built to replace an aging oil pipeline that runs across northern Minnesota. Winona LaDuc is one of the leading tribal advocates speaking out against Line 3. She says the state, including Governor Tim Walz, has let them down.
I am so dismayed by the Court of Appeals, and we will stand in resistance with thousands of others. The summer is young.
She says the ruling will result in more people arrested or hurt, with opposition surfacing along the construction route. Last week, protesters held their largest gathering yet, resulting in arrests after people locked themselves to equipment. Meanwhile, LaDuc says they're pleading with the Biden administration to intervene. Canada-based Enbridge says Line 3 creates thousands of jobs and that high degrees of safety are being applied to construction and maintenance. Installation of Line 3 is nearly 60% complete, and the court noted its presence, while troublesome to many groups and tribal members, is less of an environmental risk than the current line. But LaDuc says it's a direct threat to natural resources tribes rely on.
All of our wild rice watersheds are now subject to Enbridge's aggression and destruction.
Even if this decision is appealed to the Minnesota Supreme Court, opponents worry that would take a long time before a ruling is issued. They say that's why they want President Joe Biden to take action with construction moving forward. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
Israel bombed targets in Gaza yesterday, the first attack since last month's truce, and just 3 days after a new government was installed. The renewed violence began when thousands of flag-waving Jewish ultranationalists marched through Arab neighborhoods of Jerusalem chanting death to Arabs. Police fired rubber-tipped bullets at Palestinian protesters there. The airstrikes were in response to the launching of incendiary balloons from Gaza, which caused at least 10 fires in open fields in Israeli communities near the border. The Israeli military said it was, quote, ready for all scenarios, including renewed fighting in the face of continued terrorist acts emanating from Gaza. A Hamas spokesman confirmed the Israeli air attacks, saying Palestinians would continue to pursue their, quote, brave resistance and defend their rights and sacred sites in Jerusalem. TriMet's board of directors has hired Sam Dessou Jr. as the new general manager. He will become TriMet's first GM of color in its 5-decade history. The agency chose Dessou after a national search and extensive community involvement. Dessou is currently TriMet's interim general manager and chief operating officer. He has more than 27 years of public and private transportation experience. Dessou got his start as a bus driver in Alaska. After nearly 11 years in the Army, he worked for public transportation agencies in the Seattle and Kansas City metropolitan areas. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on myths about our prison system. After that, at 5:45, it's News from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. At 6, it's Rural Roots Rising, a show by and for rural Oregonians. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 56 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high of 84. Today in history, in 1963, Soviet cosmonaut Valentina Tereshkova became the first woman in space on the Vostok 6 mission. The quote of the day is from an anonymous source. They said, quote, NASA spent millions of dollars inventing the ballpoint pen so they could write in space. The Russians took a pencil. For dads celebrating their first Father's Day this Sunday, a few financial tips can help give their kids the best start in life. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Father's Day is approaching, and for new dads, some financial tips can help set their families up for success. First, revising household budgets and cutting out unnecessary expenses are crucial. Jordan Beyer with the Northwest Credit Union Association became a father 2 weeks ago. He says he and his spouse are saving cash by smarter meal planning to reduce food waste.
One of the things that we did is that for clothes, we bought some new clothes, but we also went and looked at some of the secondhand stores, and often we'd find brand new baby clothes that still had the tag on them for significantly less cost. And so that was a way for us to also save some funds.
Beyer also advises people to rethink their subscriptions, such as streaming services, and cancel whatever they don't use much. The Northwest Credit Union Association suggests new parents consider investing in life and disability insurance, automate their monthly bills, and build an emergency fund that can cover 6 to 12 months of living expenses. Beyer says it's important to plan for the future as well and recognize that plans might change. Financial planning services at a local financial institution can help with this. He says parents also shouldn't wait to save for higher education.
College expenses, there's no doubt, have increased dramatically year over year. And so having a plan and putting away a few extra bucks here and there, and I think the most important thing is to get started now with what you have.
There might be a lot to consider with a newborn at home, and for new parents, Beyer acknowledges it can be hard just keeping up on sleep, but he knows all the hard work and long hours are worth it.
It's a new experience for us, and all of the stressors melt away when you look at them.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed legislation aimed at controlling public school teachers' ability to accurately teach U.S. history and discuss current events. The law signed by Governor Abbott allows for the teaching of, quote, the history of white supremacy, including but not limited to the institution of slavery, the eugenics movement, and the Ku Klux Klan, and the ways in which it's morally wrong. The bill doesn't allow for schools to teach, quote, that an individual, by virtue of the individual's race or sex, bears responsibility for actions committed in the past by others in the same sex or race. It also prohibits schools from incorporating the New York Times' 1619 project into its curriculum. The governors of Idaho and Tennessee recently signed similar bills barring public school classroom discussions of the United States' long history of racism. Similar bills are moving through more than a dozen state legislatures across the country. Teachers across the U.S. have spoken out against bills like the one in Texas, with thousands gathering in more than 20 cities last weekend for a National Day of Action organized by the Zinn Education Project. Several thousand educators have also signed a pledge stating, quote, "We, the undersigned educators, refuse to lie to young people about U.S. history and current events, regardless of the law." An event was held in Fairbanks, Alaska this week in remembrance of the 215 Native children whose bodies were discovered at a residential school in British Columbia. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A gathering was recently held in Fairbanks, Alaska to mourn and raise awareness about historic abuse, neglect, and forced assimilation of Native children at government and church-run residential schools in the U.S. and Canada. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the event and others like it follow the discovery of the remains of 215 children buried at a former residential school in British Columbia.
The event included the tying of 215 bandanas to a clothesline which was then strung along a footbridge over the Chena River in downtown Fairbanks, a symbolic gesture of acknowledgement and remembrance of the children whose bodies were found buried on the grounds of the former residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia. Fairbanks event organizer Sasha Housley says her father was a boarding school survivor in Alaska, and although he never talked about his experience, she's educated herself on residential schools.
Kids were taken from their homes and from their families, and they weren't allowed to speak their language or sing their songs.
It was the government's effort to try to take the savage out of the Indian.
Shirley Mae Holmberg has a background in behavioral health and says she knows many people who were traumatized at residential schools.
I have friends and family that have been affected by boarding schools, the experience, sexual abuse, physical abuse.
The government sought to destroy our people.
Natasha Singh with Tanana Chiefs Conference also pointed to Native people's resilience in the face of systematic government oppression.
It's a beautiful day today because they failed, and we continue to thrive.
For National Native News, I'm Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Meanwhile, the Ontario government has announced a $10 million plan to identify, investigate, and commemorate unmarked burial sites of former residential schools in the province. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Ontario Premier Doug Ford says the $10 million will go to a three-year action plan to identify and commemorate unmarked burial sites at former residential schools in the province. Ford says the news of the remains found in British Columbia has deeply impacted survivors and their families.
This is a moment to recognize the painful legacy of Canada's residential school system and of the damaging, lasting effect it has had on survivors and Indigenous communities.
There were 18 residential schools in Ontario. The work to uncover unmarked burial sites will be done with archaeologists, forensic specialists, and Indigenous leaders. Greg Rickford is Ontario's Indigenous Affairs Minister.
We know that these are reopening wounds, some that have never healed. That's why it's critical that any search and recover efforts are community-led.
Francis Cavanaugh is a Grand Chief of the Okichada Grand Council Treaty 3.
Survivors have told us firsthand of children being buried in secret, off school grounds, or even cremated. I have also heard of a desire to search for our children, to bring all of our children home.
The residential school system operated across most of Canada from the late 1800s to 1996. The schools were funded by the Canadian government and run by the churches. The goal was to assimilate Native children into white society. Those children were torn from their families and communities and forced to attend the schools. Thousands were physically, sexually, and emotionally abused. Hundreds died of neglect and abuse. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A new law in Maine bans the use of certain pesticides in residential landscapes. They're called neonicotinoids, and conservationists say they're detrimental to bees, butterflies, and other pollinators. Advocates are hailing the law as the strongest in the nation when it comes to this type of pesticide. Lily Bolke has the story.
A bill signed into law last week bans the use of neonicotinoids, neonics for short, in outdoor residential landscapes. They're pesticides seen as harmful to bees and other pollinators. Anya Fetcher with Environment Maine says when neonics are sprayed on plants or applied to seeds, the toxins impair bees' brain functions, making it harder to find their way back to a hive, to collect food, to produce new queens. And she adds, these days, bees are losing more and more of their habitats to development and agriculture.
Bees are more and more relying on urban gardens and green spaces for healthy and nutritious habitat. And so that's why we need to make sure that, you know, our backyards and our lawns and gardens are safe spaces for them to come.
She says it's the nation's strongest statewide restriction on neonic use, while some states such as Massachusetts, Maryland, Connecticut, and Vermont have removed neonics from the shelves. Fetcher notes licensed applicators, such as landscapers and gardeners, still can use them in those states. Fetcher adds that pollinators are critical for many key food crops and help preserve healthy ecosystems. In Maine in particular, she says broccoli, squash, and wild blueberries rely heavily on bees.
Really, our food systems are very dependent on these natural pollinators, not to mention the beauty of Maine, our wildflowers and our greenery, and the significant reason that people live and visit Maine.
Close to 90% of wild plants and 3/4 of food crops globally rely on pollinators. She hopes more states and municipalities will follow suit in banning the use of neonics in favor of alternatives. For Maine News Service, I'm Lily Bolke.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is wary but very ready for summer.
So much to worry about, but still excited about summer. We need this time to get out, get around, be with, while the rest of the world that supplies us the food we eat, the products we enjoy, is having COVID surges and very little vaccine. Will this second summer of COVID be the last? Will this be another summer of fire after the driest spring in decades, or just a summer of drought, unrelenting heat, and any other tricks the out-of-balance weather system has up its sleeve? Biden's touring Europe. The Texas governor says they'll build their own wall. Republicans control 23 state governments. Weird how the right wing is against voting rights, LGBTQ rights, abortion rights, and in D.C. it's the usual all talk and no progress. While here in the neighborhoods, when folks aren't getting shot, there is dancing in the streets, concerts coming soon. There's a shortage of seeds because so many are gardening. We'll be charging our batteries with fresh food, roasted food, joy, and community, because that's what summer's for. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 16th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and David Rosenberg. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Lily Bolke, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. We'll be learning more about myths about our prison system.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It's not uncommon for people to think that the more people who engage in criminal behavior that we lock up, the safer that our society will be. But critics of our criminal justice system say otherwise. Victoria Law is a freelance writer and author who writes about prisons in the U.S. Her latest book is Prisons Make Us Safer and 20 Other Myths About Mass Incarceration. She spoke with KPFA Weekend News anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. He asked her why prisons don't make us any safer.
If we think about prisons, first of all, we have to remember that they are an after harm or violence or illegal actions have occurred, not before. So they actually don't prevent crime and violence for happening. If listeners think about their day-to-day life, they usually do not abstain from committing harm or violence because they are afraid of prisons. They simply don't do these things. In addition, we find that over half of violent crimes go unreported each year. And of those, even fewer result in arrest, and even fewer than those result in a conviction. So prisons don't necessarily do a fantastic job or even an effective job of addressing violence even after it happens, let alone prevent it from happening in the United States.
Prisons are supposed to have a rehabilitative function, is that right?
Supposedly, prisons are supposed to be places of rehabilitation. But what we have to remember is that prisons are often places that are crowded, they are chaotic, they are full of violence. There are very few rehabilitative or educational programs available, and the ones that were available were put on pause this past year during the coronavirus pandemic. So people who think that prisons have a robust drug treatment program, for instance, would be horrified to find out that even though hundreds of thousands of people churn through jails and prisons each year, there are very few slots for drug and alcohol treatment programs, and drugs and alcohol, at the same time, drugs and alcohol are rampant in prisons. So you are more likely to be able to continue a substance use habit than you are to be able to get support and help in abstaining from drug use or alcohol use while you are incarcerated. And at the same time, you come out of prison with a felony record, which makes it much harder to access housing, employment opportunities, other educational opportunities, and resources that would help keep you from being funneled back into prison for other illegal activities.
We hear calls in some quarters for restorative justice. Would that help alleviate the problem you're talking about?
I think that restorative justice has been an underutilized method in addressing harm and violence that happens between people. Under restorative justice, people who have caused harm or who have caused violence come together with the people whom they have harmed. Unlike the criminal justice system as it is now, restorative justice centers the need that the survivors have. What do they need to heal and move on with their lives from the harm that has happened? What do they want the person to do to not only start to make up for the harm that they have done, but to ensure that they will not cause that kind of harm to somebody else again, and what needs to happen so that this person can be held accountable. Right now, what we have is a system, if we look at the criminal justice system, that sends people to prison, and no one is ever forced to take accountability or responsibility or even reflect on the harm that they did to someone else. Instead, they are encouraged again and again to deny any sense of wrongdoing or minimize any harm that they have done to try to get a lesser penalty or not be convicted of a crime, rather than to say, wow, I didn't realize that when I robbed you on a darkened street, I instilled a fear in you that has a ripple effect so that you are always afraid to walk down certain streets or to leave your house after dark. Or I've caused worry in your family. Now, if you don't come home by a certain time, your mother worries that perhaps something bad has happened to you, or your children worry that maybe mommy or daddy won't come home. So restorative justice forces somebody to reckon with the harm that they've done and, as its name implies, try to restore that person to the condition that they were in before.
Do you think our prison system needs to be dismantled? And if so, what would you replace it with?
I do believe the prison system needs to be dismantled. I don't believe that we should be looking for a one-on-one replacement. You cannot take out the system of mass incarceration that the United States has and find another giant block that can encompass 2.2 million people and put it in its place. Instead, what we need to be looking at is what can we have in our society that supports people to either not engage in criminalized behaviors or harmful behaviors, and what do people need to survive and thrive? So if we look at the numbers of people who are in prison for robbery, what needs to happen? What are the root causes of people robbing other people? Well, poverty, for one thing, lack of educational and job opportunities, another thing. So what needs to happen in our society so that we don't have robberies happening? What needs to happen so that we don't have, say, domestic violence, which is not solved by the threat of prison, because if prisons prevented domestic violence, we would not have any in this country. So I think instead of looking at a one-on-one, a one-to-one substitute, we need to be looking at what needs to happen in our society so that we are not incarcerating so many people. One of the things I look at in my book, Prisons Make Us Safer, and 20 other myths about mass incarceration, is the Norwegian prison system, which has about 4,000 people in its prison system, not necessarily because Norway's prison system is fantastic, although they do treat people more humanely, but because Norway has a more robust public services system in the first place, where it provides for its citizens so that people don't fall into criminalized activity and end up in prison.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you if there are any models in the world for what we might do. And you mentioned one country. Any place else where they have some sort of better system, I guess you could say, than we do?
I think that when we think about what other countries are doing, we also have to think of what they are doing in the context of that country. Like, we could not take Norway's more humane prison system, where people are incarcerated for no more than 20 years, for the most part, except for if you commit genocide, in which case then you might be incarcerated for 30 years, on something that resembles a college campus, where you are not necessarily locked in a cell, you have access to educational programs, vocational programs, you are treated as if you are a person, and you are treated as if you are a person who is going to return as a neighbor, a family member, and a community member after a set period of time. But we also have to remember that Norway has a very homogenous population compared to the United States. So there are not all of the racial and racist undertones of policing and incarceration and who they send to prison. And they have a more robust social welfare system, which means that fewer of their citizens are forced into criminalized activity than what we have in the United States. So I think when we look at what other countries are doing, we can draw lessons from how they treat people in prison, but we should also look at how do they treat people in that country to prevent them from being sent to prison in the first place.
Are there people who need to be locked up for long periods of time just because they are a threat to public safety?
I think that we should ask ourselves, yes, there are people who should not necessarily be returned to society right away. So if we were to talk about dismantling the prison system, there are a small handful of people that perhaps would not necessarily be safe to be out in society. But what we have done is we have taken this small handful of people and we have built a giant prison system that encompasses 2.2 million people. And we now treat everybody as if they are this small handful of Ted Kaczynskis or Dylan Roofs or Timothy McVeighs, rather than saying, if we don't have this giant system in which we funnel billions of dollars of funding and resources and we divert these from community resources, well, we don't have anything else to address these types of egregious harms right now. But what could we do if we got rid of prisons and we said, okay, now what do we do with this very small handful of people who need much more help than just being put in a prison cell and being locked away for 23, 24 hours a day for the rest of their lives? What could we do to make sure that they are able to, if not safely, be reintegrated into society, be treated more humanely and not simply locked away as if this is going to somehow solve all of society's problems or prevent the next Dylan Roof or the next Timothy McVeigh or the next January 6th armed insurrectionist from coming up?
In some places, I'm thinking particularly of California, people have been let out of prison simply because the prisons are too crowded. Is there something hopeful about that, that maybe that will lead to further reform?
Yes. I mean, I think that for the people who are let out, particularly people who thought that they might be spending the rest of their lives in prison or a good portion of the rest of their lives in prison, this is a tremendous beacon of hope for them and for their families. And then for other, and then I think we should also look at the fact that California was forced. California as a state did not come to this realization on its own. California was forced by the Supreme Court to start reducing its prison overcrowding because in 2011, the Supreme Court ruled that California's extensive prison overcrowding was a violation of the Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unusual punishment. But the fact that California, which was one of the early lock them up and throw away the key, three strikes and you're out proponents, is now starting to reverse that is a beacon of hope, because we can see that these tough on crime, lock them up forever policies have not been working. And at the same time, you can start letting, you can let people out and not necessarily have the chaos and violence that tough on crime proponents have been predicting for years and years and years. People get out and they try to reintegrate into their lives. If people get out with support, they are less likely to be sent back to prison for violating terms of their parole or violating terms of their probation because they can't survive. If people are let out and resources are redirected to the communities that have been hardest hit by both policing, incarceration, and a lack of resources in the first place, there would be fewer people being sent to prison if there were more mental health resources, educational resources, housing opportunities, employment opportunities. So I think, yes, we can see this as a hopeful step. If people are being let out and we're not playing a shell game of letting some people out and then putting more people in under a different rubric.
It still seems like it's easy for politicians to use the issue of violent crime to get elected. You know, for example, with these anti-Asian incidents, you know, people see some of this stuff on TV, people have their video phone cameras on, and they're just outraged in a different way, as people are outraged when they see police attack people. But, you know, there's this public demand, it seems, for these people to be locked up because the acts they've committed are so despicable.
I mean, everybody wants to feel safe. As an Asian American and as a Asian American woman who also has Asian American family members, I also want to feel safe when I walk down the street. I want my parents to feel safe. My grandparents are not alive, but if they were, I would want them to be safe. I would want everybody's grandparents to be safe. But what we have to remember is that violence and hate against Asians and Asian Americans is not new. We have had this ever since the 1800s, and policing and prisons have not stemmed anti-Asian violence. Nobody has been deterred from lashing out against Asians or Asian Americans by the threat of arrest or incarceration. I mean, the day after the mass shooting in Atlanta, where a 21-year-old white man shot and killed 8 people at 3 different Asian-owned spas, 6 of whom were Asian women, the following day in the Bay Area, young white man was arrested after he attacked first an elderly Asian man, and then he attacked an elderly Asian woman who picked up a piece of wood and beat the tar out of him, and he was arrested. But the news of the Atlanta shooting, you know, made national news, and it did not deter this other racist young man from attacking Asian people that he deemed vulnerable. So we see that policing in prisons is not keeping people from attacking Asian people or people that they deem vulnerable or people that they don't like because of their race or their gender identity or their sexuality. We see again and again and again that when there are attacks on Asian people, when there are attacks on gay people, when there have been attacks on Muslim people, there's been a call for more policing because people want to feel safe, not necessarily because people want there to be more police, but because we as a society give people the fake options of you can either have police or you can have nothing. And we don't say, what are the other options we can have for community safety? How do we actually protect people in our community? And how do we nip these hateful ideologies that move people to racism from spreading any further?
Yeah, that's the deterrence argument. But I think a lot of people would say these people need to be punished right now. They need to be taken off the streets. If they're not, there's a sense of justice denied. Would you agree with that?
I actually do not. I mean, I actually look at a case in Oregon where an Asian man was attacked on the street by a random person. And what he demanded was not that the person go to jail, but recognize that this person obviously had mental health issues that were being unmet, that he had absorbed the hateful rhetoric. We have to remember that we just came out of, or we are coming out of, the coronavirus pandemic, which then President Trump tried to blame on Chinese people and Asian people for not only the coronavirus, but the government's failure to respond and the government's continued failed response to the coronavirus pandemic. So he scapegoated people who it was very easy to deflect blame onto. But we're coming out of this, and sending people to jail or to prison will not necessarily stop the next person. So in Oregon, the person who had been victimized by somebody said, I want this person to get mental health resources. I want him to participate in a restorative justice process mediated by the Chinese American Planning Council of that town. I want that person to actually be put into some sort of anti-racism program so that we can start to disentangle this racist rhetoric that Asian people are responsible for the coronavirus or Asian people are responsible for the failed economy that accompanied the pandemic, and instead start to untangle that, because sending this person to prison means that this person will end up hanging out with people who are probably going to reinforce his racist rhetoric. He will continue to believe this racist rhetoric. He will not get any sort of help in disentangling himself from this racist and violent behavior, and then will come out and still be possibly a menace to other people. And what will we have to show for it besides having spent $50,000, $60,000 each year to incarcerate this person who comes out just as hateful and just as misguided as when he went in?
Anything else you want to add to what you've said?
I think that what we have to also think about is that the United States has 5% of the world's population and between 20 to 25% of the world's prison population. If prisons made us safer, we should be the safest nation in the world. And as our conversation just showed, with the rise in attacks against Asian American people, with attacks against Jewish people, you know, with people who still pose threats to other people, prisons have not done anything to make us safer. Instead, they're a false solution to cover up the fact that we still live in a nation which fails to address societal, economic, and all sorts of other problems.
That was freelance writer and author Victoria Law speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Jenna Yokoyama, and I'm also one of the interim station co-managers.